This morning's message is going to be somewhat of a different format. And the reason I say that is because we're going to pick apart an article that recently came out in a Newsweek. It's Newsweek, December 24th, 1990. Anybody you see this Newsweek, it's the front cover. You can't hardly, I mean, if you saw it, you'd remember it. In big, bold letters, as if carved in cement, it's got the words "Thought Police." And it says, "Watch what you say, thought police. There's a politically correct way to talk about race, sex, and ideas. Is this the new Enlightenment or the new McCarthyism?" Anybody see that article or read that article? You know, occasionally the enemies of Christ, it's not probably real often, but I think we're seeing it with more rapidity as time goes on. And as the more that I think America and Christianity becomes enslaved, the more bold they are, and occasionally, and again, more often, I think we are starting to see them start to tell us what they're doing to us. At different times when they think under a particular format that they can get away with it, they almost as if they're bragging that this is what we're doing to you. Regretfully, we have been so deprogrammed and so brainwashed. They have such mind control, I think, over us, where, or at least the American populace generally, that most don't even pick it up when they're telling us. Well, this, I believe, is one of those articles where they are admitting to us what they're doing to us. What we want to do is just simply, we're going to, in this message, just simply go through this article and kind of relate what it's saying and pick it apart in light of God's Word and in light of truth. I think it's one that certainly deserves our attention. Like I said, man, it can't help but get your attention if you saw it when it says "thought police," especially in light of some of the things that we already understand are going on in this day and age. Well, let's just take this article or this Newsweek. That's actually not the title of the article we're going to deal with, but we'll take this article, which is called "Taking Offense." And pick it apart. Again, it says, "Is this the new Enlightenment on campus or the new McCarthyism?" Let's just start with paragraph 1 and sentences 1 through 4. It says, "Perhaps Nina Wu, a sophomore at the University of Connecticut, actually didn't like gays. More likely, she thought she was being funny when she allegedly put up a sign on the door to her dorm room listing, quote, 'people who are shot on sight,' end quote. Among them, preppies, bimbos, men without chest hair, and homos. No protests were heard from representatives of the first three categories. But University of Connecticut's gay community was more forthright in asserting its prerogatives. Wu was brought up on charges of violating a student behavior code, which had recently been rewritten to prohibit, quote, posting or advertising publicly offensive, indecent, or abusive matter concerning persons and making personal slurs or epithets based on race, sex, ethnic origin, disability, religion, or sexual orientation." And we'll stop there just a minute and examine a little bit of what's said there. Now, there was this policy from which this Nina Wu was taken up for what she had posted on her door, because this new policy that had been instated in this particular university had said that you could not use abusive matter, that you could not, excuse me, post or advertise abusive matter concerning persons and making personal slurs or epithets based on race, sex, ethnic origin, disability, religion, or sexual orientation. Now, in order to examine that the way that I think we should, we probably ought to examine some of those things that they had said are illegal for students to do in their particular college. Let's look at some of those terms that they said, or some of the things they said you are not permitted to do. Abusive matter, slurs, and epithets. Now let me ask the question in relation to those. Are those things always wrong? Abusive matter, slurs, or epithets? I don't know about you, I didn't know what epithets were, so we're going to have to look at the definitions. And let's look at the definitions for all of those, or those three things. Now, what I want to use for the definitions, oftentimes I go back to Webster's 1828 dictionary. In some situations, it's certainly the dictionary we should go back to really understand the correct meaning and terms or definitions for certain terms or words. In this case, because we're talking about a situation on a university, I decided that probably the best dictionary to go to was Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, since we're dealing with college campuses. Let's start with the word, or the phrase, abusive matter, defining the word abusive. In Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, the second, it's the one that's most applicable in the way that they're using it, the second definition is, it says, characterized by or serving for verbal abuse. And then in order to understand maybe what that is saying, we needed to look up the word abuse. Its first meaning in this dictionary is to attack in words, revile. And then its fourth meaning goes on to say to use so as to injure or damage. We also looked up the word slurs. It's defined in the same dictionary as 1A as being an insulting or disparaging remark or innuendo, B as shaming or degrading effect. And then we looked up epithets, which in its 1B definition is a disparaging or abusive word or phrase. Actually, as you heard the definitions for those words, you can see there isn't really a lot of difference between all three phrases or words. It basically is all defining verbal abuse, a reviling, insulting, or disparaging marks. They're all, in that sense, very similar. Now, again, let me ask you the question I asked before defining those terms. Is verbal abuse, reviling, insulting, or disparaging remarks always wrong? Now, if I was speaking to before probably any other pulpit other than the one I'm standing behind now, if I was standing behind and speaking from any other pulpit in this town, asking that question before people who call themselves Christians, I can just about guarantee you that their answer to that question would be yes, it is always wrong. Christianity, if we're Christians, we don't do those kind of things. It's against what the Scriptures teach. And, of course, they probably even have some Scriptures to back up their answer to that question. They might maybe use 1 Corinthians 10 and verses 32 and 33, where we're told, where Paul writes and says, giving no offense. Remember, the title of this article is Taking Offense. He says, giving no offense to either Jews or to Greeks or to the church of God, just as I also please all men in all things, not seeking my own profit, but the profit of the many, that they may be saved. Or maybe 2 Corinthians chapter 6 would be used, where it says in one of the verses there, giving no offense in anything, in order that the ministry be not discredited. And they'd use those scriptures and say, see, that is not to be done. Christians don't do those kinds of things. They don't use that kind of verbiage. That this article is talking about, that this university in Connecticut condemned. And of course, they would probably, as a result, be in full support of this behavior code, or of this university student behavior code. You know, as a result of them taking that stand, as I believe probably the biggest majority of Christianity, and again, I probably would want to put quotes around Christianity, but the biggest majority of Christianity would probably, as a result of taking that stand, would then also, as a result of taking that stand along with the college, backing up the college in their stand in this area, they would also have to bring up John the Immerser, the Apostle Paul, the Apostle Peter, and even Yahshua the Christ himself on the same charges that Nina Wu was brought up on. Keep in mind, the areas which the university identified as taboo, in the areas that they said you cannot do these things in, the areas of race or ethnic origin, the area of sex, the area of, or speaking of the different sexes, the area of disability, religion, and sexual orientation. Those were the areas, and keep that in mind as we now look at these other men, these men of the Bible who are certainly supposed to be our examples, who are so often used as examples. And thus, if, again, the churches today or the Christians or the preachers today would want to say there's never a place for those things, then these, and I'll show you, I will prove it to you, these men and even Yahshua the Christ, the Messiah, as well, would have to be brought up on the same charges. In light of those areas, let's look at some of these men and some of the things they said. Let's take John the Immerser, for example, first. In Matthew 3:7, you won't need to turn to these, I'll just read them to you. In Matthew 3:7, listen to what he said. He said, when he saw many of the Pharisees and Sadducees coming for immersion, he said to them, you brood of vipers, who warned you to flee from the wrath to come? Now, would anyone question that he was dealing with these Pharisees with their religion? He called them what he called them because of their religion. Now, let me ask, do you think that the Pharisees would have considered that verbal abuse or a reviling by John the Immerser? What do you think? Not about you, but I think they would have probably taken offense at what John the Immerser had to say in relation to their religion. Here's another area. Not only did John use a reviling in the area of religion for the Pharisees, but he even deals with sexual preference as well. Now, you understand what I mean what they mean when they're talking about sexual preference, don't you? Whether you want to have sex with your wife, or whether you want to have sex with another man, or whether you want to have sex with a child, or whether you want to have sex with a dog. That's what they're talking about when they're talking about sexual preference. Did these men ever deal with this thing that's so taboo today in our society and in this particular college and probably many similar colleges as well? Well, Matthew 14:3-4, still examining John the Immerser. At that time, when Herod had John arrested on account of Herodias, the wife of his brother Philip, it says that he arrested John. Why? Because he had been saying, quote, it is not lawful for you to have her. Well, today, that's nothing. I mean, we're talking about some other things that are far beyond that. Today's you wouldn't even think about maybe challenging, or at least society wouldn't think about challenging someone for simply having your brother's wife, for committing adultery. But even it was at that point, half the time you wouldn't even thought about the things that are going on today. So John the Immerser, he did deal with sexual preference. That wasn't allowable. And John knew it, and John preached it according to God's law. How about the Apostle Paul? Did he ever revile or abuse people with things that he said concerning different areas? How about in the area of religion? In Philippians 3:2, he said, beware of the dogs, beware of the evil workers, beware of the false circumcision. Again, would anybody question, or if those on the end of that abuse, would they think that he was praising them? Of course not. He was giving them verbal abuse. What was he dealing with? What religious preference was he dealing with? Well, he was dealing with the Judaizers, those who taught and preached Judaism. He also dealt with sexual preference, and without a question, in Romans chapter 1, he not only said disparaging things about queers, but he made it clear that they even deserve death. And he didn't avoid even the sex issue, male, female, so forth and so on. You know, women have taken his remarks about women over centuries to be abusive. Now, in this case, he wasn't being abusive. He was just stating the way that God intended things to be. But it's certainly taken to be abusive by women, many women of today. Though indeed it was not. And even Yahshua the Christ didn't avoid those kind of situations that needed to be dealt with, and sometimes with verbal abuse. For example, dealing with the race, with race and ethnic origin. You know, it took me a little while to come up with an illustration there. I didn't know that there was, should have dawned on me right away, but at first I didn't think there was probably one that dealt with, where these men dealt with race or ethnic origin. But there certainly is one that you and I are very familiar with. In Matthew 15:22-27, when a Canaanite woman came to have her daughter healed, what did he say to that Canaanite woman? He said, I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And then he later says, it is not good to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs. Now, many people do not like to hear that. But I can't help that. That is in the Scriptures. And anybody who reads that can understand that he was taking the Canaanite, and I don't think he specifically was dealing with that woman as an individual, but he was taking the Canaanite religion. And if you know anything about the Canaanite religion of that time and previous times, you can understand why Yahshua would call them dogs. contrast to calling Israel his sheep. Now, Israel certainly sometimes didn't even deserve that. But you can understand why he did what he did if you understand who the Canaanites were and what some of their practices were. The point is that he called her, at least her people, their ethnic origin, he called them dogs. And I certainly wasn't, if anything, you could call it a slur. He used it because it was appropriate to use it in that particular situation. And thus he himself, in that area, could have been taken up on the same charges. And by the way, she admits to the same thing. You know, it wasn't just that Yahshua called her that. She responds to him. She said, even the dogs get to lick up the crumbs that fall from their master's table. And so she admitted, yes, we're dogs, but Lord, can't you still see fit to heal my daughter? And with her faith and with her retort in that matter, he did heal her daughter. Or at least through her faith, her daughter was healed. Not only that, but he also dealt with religion very clearly in the same matter. In Matthew 23, he labels the scribes and the Pharisees and their religion. He labels them as hypocrites, sons of hell, blind guides, fools, whitewashed tombs, serpents, and a brood of vipers. And again, I don't think anybody would question that those were disparaging, reviling, and abusive language in dealing with these people and their religions. Why? Because there was a point to it. Now, the previous scriptures that I used, that I said many Christians today would probably use to try to back up their position that is never allowable, obviously need to be understood in light of these examples. That is not a contradiction. It's not as if Yahshua and Paul and John, and I could use Peter as an example as well, were in contradiction to the inspired teachings of the scriptures. No, it has to be what was said in those other passages in 1 and 2 Corinthians has to be understood in light of what they were dealing with. Basically, if you examine those passages in light of their context, you'll find that they were dealing with not being a stumbling block to someone unnecessarily so. That's what it was dealing with when it was talking about not being an offense to anyone. But there is, we need to understand, and we can see it by example, that there is a time and a place to call a spade a spade. And we certainly see it in those examples. Have you ever noticed that those people who get most upset with what Nina Wu, for example, did are those people when the reviling hits the mark, when it's the truth, you know, when they've got something to hide even, when it's the truth. You know, men without chest hair didn't mind her having that on the wall. Even the bimbos didn't. I don't even know what a bimbo is for sure. Maybe they should have. I don't know. Goofball? Okay. Well, the bimbos didn't even mind. Is it more than that? It seemed like it was... Oh, is that what it is? Well, the prostitutes probably got mad at it too because they had something to hide. Anyway, it's those people who have something to hide when truth hurts. And the homosexuals all of a sudden got all upset with it. Classic example of this is really found with, at least from the scriptures, is found with Stephen in the book of Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7, starting with verse 51 through 54, it says, "You men," now he's just preached to them a message, basically giving them the history of the Israelites. He's speaking before a group of men, and he says at the very near the end of his message to them, Stephen says, "You men who are stiff-necked and uncircumcised in heart and ears are always resisting the Holy Spirit. You are doing just as your fathers did. Which one of the prophets did your fathers not persecute? And they killed those who had previously announced the coming of the righteous one, who betrayers and murderers you have now become. You who received the law as ordained by angels, yet did not keep it." And then verse 54, it says, always he was getting too close to home. It was all right to talk about history, but don't you dare talk about us. It says, "Now when they heard this, they were cut to the quick, and they began gnashing their teeth at him." And then in verse 57 and 58, "But they cried out with a loud voice and covered their ears, and they rushed upon him with one impulse. And when they had driven him out of the city, they began stoning him, and the witnesses laid aside their robes at the feet of a young man named Saul." Classic example. Boy, people get upset when you get too close to home with those kind of remarks, just like they, of course, did with Yahshua. He got too close to home, and they crucified him for some of the things that he said. Well, that's a classic example. Let's go on with the article now and see what else it has to say. Now, picking up right from where we left, it says, found guilty last year in a campus administrative hearing, Wu was, what would you guess, reprimanded or ordered to write a letter of apology? What would you guess? No, Wu was ordered to move off campus and forbidden to set foot in any university dormitories or cafeterias. What had she done? Had she physically abused someone? Had she raped somebody? Had she done anything of that kind? No, she was forced to leave the university simply because she had thought something she shouldn't thought, and she put it on her door. Let's go on. Let's go to paragraph 2 now. It says, there is an... Now listen carefully to this part, this first part that I'm going to read to you. First two sentences of paragraph 2, it says, there is an experiment of sorts taking place in American colleges, or more accurately, hundreds of experiments at different campuses directed at changing the consciousness of this entire generation of university students. Now, did you catch what they were really saying in that with what they said? Notice again, it says that there's these hundreds of experiments taking place across the campuses in the United States, and it says directed at changing the consciousness of this entire generation of university students. Why? Why would the universities want to change the consciousness of an entire generation of college students? Well, maybe Bertrand Russell, the Fabian socialist who coined the phrase, better read than dead, had the answer. Listen carefully to what he had to say at one point, or what he wrote. It says, I think the subject which will be of most importance is mass psychology. Hang on to that, because we're going to talk a little bit more about that here in a minute. I think the subject which may be of most importance is mass psychology. A little later he wrote, it may be hoped that in time, anybody will be able to persuade anybody of anything if he can catch the patient young and is provided by the state with money and equipment, end quote. Now, let me stop there, and let me read a little bit more of this article before I finish reading the rest of his quote. Listen carefully. Again, he says, it may be hoped that in time anybody will be able to persuade anybody of anything if he can catch the patient young and is provided by the state with money and equipment. This is paragraph 16, sentences 1 of 2 of that paragraph. It says, the Ford Foundation gave grants totaling $1.6 million to 19 colleges and universities this year for, quote, diversity, end quote. Tulane received a grant for a program, quote, to focus the attention of administration, faculty, and students on the responsibility of each to welcome and encourage all members of the university community, regardless of their race, gender, sexual orientation, or religious beliefs. So even this article goes on to explain how that fits in exactly with what Bertrand Russell had to say. Continuing with his quote now, he goes on, quote, the subject will make great strides when it is taken up by scientists under a scientific dictatorship. The populace, keep in mind, they said the whole generation, in this article it's talked about the whole generation of college students, that's going to, their consciousness is planned to be, they're planning to change. It says the populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions, where do convictions begin? In the consciousness. The populace will not be allowed to know how its convictions came from the... convictions were generated. When the technique has been perfected, every government that has been in charge of education for a generation will be able to control its subjects securely without the need of armies or policemen. End quote. Why would they want to take over the consciousness, the convictions of a whole generation of college students? Well, obviously so that they can control and subjugate a whole nation. I found this in my in one of my files preparing this message. It's out of somebody's newsletter. I don't even know what it was. It's from November 1986. It's tore out, so I can't even give credit to whom credit is deserved in this. But listen, man, I'm going to just read what this newsletter had to say under a title called, listen to it, Group Consciousness and Manipulated Masses. And whoever it was had something very pertinent in relation to what I've just read you, both out of this article and from Bertrand Russell. Group Consciousness and Manipulated Masses. Mass manipulation of our language has destroyed. And you're going to find out that's exactly what this article is dealing with primarily, is language. Mass manipulation of our language has destroyed our thought processes so that individuals have ceased to function as anything other than as a part of a group. Group manipulators, parentheses, government authorities, end parentheses, must destroy individual sovereignty and individual creative consciousness so that interaction between individuals and total reality is destroyed. World-controlled groups are crowding out the individual until he yields to conformity and the, quote, public conscious, end quote. There is I don't want to read that part. He goes on. He says, we have reached a time when any thought of self is coupled with feelings of guilt. Manipulated groups and the whole manipulated society has been used to kill off individualism and effectively isolate and silence anyone not accepting direction from group manipulation, that is, authority. Keep in mind that it talks about trying to destroy individualism. You might remember in a couple messages or last week's message the fact that I quoted from Psychopolitics, that is one of their goals, is to destroy rugged individualism. Goes on, the quality of human life goes down as individuality is destroyed. Slaves to group consciousness produce things, but not quality of life. The essence, catch this last part, the essence of what we are saying here is that the manipulators use words not to communicate, but as weapons of warfare against the people, and particularly against the individualist who does not believe government propaganda. Again, I wish I could give credit to whoever wrote that, because it's awfully good, and it just seems to fit in perfectly, as if he knew that I would be preaching this message. So what's the purpose? Again, what's the reason for doing all of this? Literally, we can just call it what it is. It's brainwashing. Well, it's for the purpose, again, of control and subjugation. That is the purpose of what's being described here in this article. Okay, let's go on further into this article. Let's go to, again, paragraph 2 and picking up where we left off. It says, the goal is to eliminate prejudice. Now, I want to stop there before I read the rest of it. They say the goal in all that's being discussed in this article is to eliminate prejudice. But we need to ask the question, who is going to determine what is prejudice and what is not? You know, so much of what's being called prejudice today is certainly not prejudiced at all. You'll see that more clearly, I think, as we continue on. You know, the real goal, they say the goal is to eliminate prejudice. Let me tell you what I think the real goal is. As we will see as we continue, it's the elimination of all dissenters. Either conform to our way of thinking about prejudice or be eliminated. I think you'll see that either in this message or the one to come, the follow-up. Going on, it says, again, the goal is to eliminate prejudice, not just of the petty sort that shows up on sophomore dorm walls, listen to this, but the grand prejudice that has ruled American universities since their founding. Listen, that the intellectual tradition of Western Europe occupies the central place in the history of civilization. Well, doesn't it? Well, if it does, if that's the truth, and who can debate that that's the truth? Western civilization we have always been behind almost every great civilization that's ever taken place in society. That's not even debatable. But they say it's prejudice to say it. It goes on, in this context, it would not be enough for a student to refrain from insulting homosexuals or other minorities. He or she would be expected to affirm their presence on campus and to study their literature and culture alongside that of Plato, Shakespeare, and Locke. This agenda is broadly shared by most organizations of minority students, feminist and gays. It's interesting to see who are the ones who are behind it as well. me later. It is also the program of, it continues, it is also the program of a generation of campus radicals who grew up in the 60s and are now achieving positions of academic influence. If they no longer talk of taking to the streets, it is because they now are gaining access to the conventional weapons of campus politics, social pressure, academic perks, including tenure, and when they have the administration on their side, outright coercion. Basically, what they're talking about there is the rewriting of history. And they've already done much of that in the past with our history. They've taken, especially with the history of the United States of America, we see them continually taking more and more and more of the Christian history of this country and throwing it out completely. Well, this again is dealing with the rewriting of history, or in other words, just simply more brainwashing. That's really what this and the next week's message is all about. It's about what's being done in the area of brainwashing in today's society. Let's go now to paragraph chapter 5 and read just the first part, or the first sentence. It says, the content of PC. Now, let me explain what they mean by PC, because that's what this article, again, is dealing with, and they're going to use the term over and over again throughout there. PC stands for politically... what's the word? Politically correct. Stands for politically correct. Now, what they mean, they give some examples of what they mean when they say PC or politically correct. For example, under people of color, it has here in a box, it says, when an African-American writer, even an African-American writer, at Cornell substituted colored students for students of color, he ran afoul of the PC police. Even the black man. You have to say it correctly. It's not colored students. You have to say it correctly. It's students of color. Here's another example. Differently abled is a politically correct term. A term that underlines the concept that differently abled individuals are not less or inferior in any way, as the word disabled implies. And they have a picture of a man in a wheelchair. You don't... Politically incorrect is saying that person is a disabled person. Politically correct is saying that he's differently abled. Another example, woman, spelled W-O-M-Y-N, woman. No one has no one has suggested renaming the sexes, only the way they're spelled. Woman, W-O-M-Y-N, takes the men out of women. That still leaves the son in person. So somehow they're going to figure out and get rid of the son in person as well. That's politically correct. Now let me share with you a couple other articles that I think describes and shows what happens if you are not politically correct, or you're not a PC kind of person in your language. Amazing the way God provides. I just opened these last night. Came in the mail yesterday, and I just opened the package last night, and these two particular articles clipped out of some newspapers fit in perfectly. Here's one. It's titled, it's from the Associated Press. It's entitled Teacher Questions Holocaust. And this is kind of close to home here. It's dealing with a school teacher in Hinckley High School in Aurora, Colorado, which was a school that I happened to have a lot of students in when I was youth minister with the church in Aurora. So it's close to home here. Aurora, it says, a Hinckley High School teacher demoted after encouraging students to question historical accounts of the Holocaust has filed suit against the Aurora Public School System, claiming her academic freedoms have been limited. The controversy stems from a class taught by a language arts teacher, Dorothy Grotoluskin, about World War II and the Holocaust, in which 6 million Jews were exterminated by the Nazis. She was demoted for her position as head of the school's language arts department for referring to the Holocaust as Holocaux and for giving students an article entitled Swindlers of the Crematoria, which contends the Holocaust was a giant hoax and many Jews died of starvation rather than extermination. Grotoluskin denies, and if she happens to get this back, I'm going to apologize. In case she ever happens to get this, I need to apologize. I'm sure that's not how you spell it, but she's got one of those names. Anyway, Grotoluskin denies telling her students that denied telling her students that the mass murders did not occur. Quote, I merely expressed my opinion that not everyone agrees on the facts of the Holocaust. In fact, I do not question the historicity of the Holocaust, end quote. Now notice, a little bit different from what they're accusing her of, she says, hey, all I was doing is providing the other side. The Aurora Public School District reprimanded her for the incident in 1987, claiming her views could be seen as anti-Semitic. In other words, they weren't politically correct. The quote, the views you expressed, this is from the Aurora Public District, they said, the quote, the views you expressed to your classes are highly offensive to the Jews and to others and are not adequately supported by fact, end quote, the district wrote. Continuing, quote, we will not tolerate your expressing such views during the performance of your teaching duties. We also view your statements and your action as being an extremely poor exercise of judgment, end quote, or an extremely poor use of politically correct language. You can certainly add in there. Grotoleskine's suit claims the district is forcing her to teach just one side of the issue and is limiting her, quote, right to exercise academic freedom and free speech, end quote. The woman needs to learn a lesson. There's not a whole lot of free speech left, especially when you have to be politically correct in all that you say. Frank O'Hare, director of Aurora Education Association, said the issue at stake is academic freedom and the ability of teachers to discuss controversial subjects in the classroom. In other words, we've got to determine whether what can be said is politically correct or not. Here's another one of interest, especially in light of a Sunday school class we had not too long ago talking about the Dead Sea Scrolls and why it's taking so long for them to get out. This is called Sea Scrolls, Lead Editor Dismissed. Israelis replace, quote, Jew-hating, quote, man, end quote, man. In his announcement Monday, Amir Dorori, the director of the Israel Antiquities Authority, said Strugnell, who was chief editor of the Dead Sea Scrolls, was being relieved at the suggestion of the agency's three-man Scrolls Advisory Committee. Goes on a little bit later. He says he created a storm in Israel after an interview published on November 9th in the Haaretz newspaper. Strugnell, who is Roman Catholic, described Judaism as, quote, a racist religion just like Hinduism, end quote, in India. Asked what bothered him about Judaism, he said, quote, the fact that it survives. It should have disappeared. The solution to the Jewish problem, in my view, is mass conversion to Christianity, and this is, of course, Christian theology, not my dear option, end quote. Struggle denied he is anti-Jewish. Quote, I don't love or hate Jews more than I love or hate anybody else. There are Jews I can't stand, and there are Christians, Catholics even, I can stand even less, end quote. He was severely criticized for the comments. The weekly Jerusalem Report magazine headlined its article, quote, the Jew hater who controls the scrolls, end quote. And several editorials questioned whether a man with his opinions should continue as editor. Why? Was it something he said that wasn't true? No, again, they don't debate that. Never debated, never challenged. It wasn't politically correct, not only in the universities, but out amongst society as well. Be an interesting man, I'm sure, to speak with and find out the real reason why those Dead Sea Scrolls are not getting to the public. Could it be that they further validate, or maybe they're even the reason why he believes now as he does in this area? So you've got to be politically correct. Let's go on with paragraph 5. Paragraph 5, in just sentence 1, it says, again, the content of PC is in some respects uncontroversial. Oh, yeah? And here's why they say that. Who would defend racism? Well, I guess it all depends on how you define racism. Let's go back to Webster's Collegiate Dictionary, and let's use their definition for what racism is. Definition. It says a belief, matter of fact, it's only definition. It says a belief that race is the primary determinant of human traits. Hear that again. A belief that race is the primary determinant of human traits and capacities, and that racial differences produce an inherent superiority of a particular race. Now let me ask you, they ask who would defend racism, I ask who would argue with that definition? You know, for example, who would argue today? Who would argue that blacks, because of their race, because of their genetic makeup, because of who they are and where they come from,
that blacks are superior in the more physical sports we have today, such as football, basketball, boxing, and those kinds of things. Who would argue that? And that fits in perfectly with the definition we just read on racism. In that sense, I think I could defend racism, couldn't you? That they are, because of who they are and their race, they're more superior as a people in those areas. No one would argue that. There's, of course, some exceptions to the rules, but you look at football and basketball, all you have to do, the facts are fact. Look at boxing, and you can find out the majority today are those that are of that race. There are exceptions to the rule, but as the saying goes, the exception proves the rule. Now, who would argue the fact that whites are more superior in the finesse sports? Oh, there'd be lots of hands probably get raised up on that one. But facts are facts. Look at the cases. Look at gymnastics. Look at tennis. Look at ice skating. There's been some exceptions, but they have a greater superiority in those areas because of what their race is. It can't be argued. You may not like talking about the whites in that sense, because we don't dare talk about them being superior in any sense. But facts are facts. The proof is in the pudding. Now, according to the definition that I just read, what I've described in those illustrations is racism. That's when I make those comments, or anybody that would agree to those comments, they're guilty of racism. So it all depends on what your definition of racism is. And regretfully, bad examples of racism in this day and age are being used to suppress the good examples of racism. There's nothing wrong with saying that about the blacks, and there's nothing wrong with saying that about the whites either. And so bad examples, and there are certainly bad examples, and there certainly is bad racism out there, but that's being used to suppress the good examples of racism. Now, an example of a good example of racism is even found in this article, though it is suppressed. You'll see how. Let me go to paragraphs 8 and 9. Out of paragraph 8, it identifies who's going to be spoken of here. It's a professor, Vincent Sarek, of the University of California, Berkeley. Then it says this about him. It says he holds scientifically controversial views about the relationship. Listen to this. He holds scientifically controversial views about the relationship of brain size to intelligence, which tend toward the politically unthinkable conclusion that some races could have a genetic edge in intellect. That has been proven. Now, we don't hear the scientific studies that have been done in those areas very often at all. We're not privy to them. Why? Because they're not politically correct. They're not politically acceptable. And thus, as a result, it says he does not, however, bring these up in his introductory course. As an anthropologist, Sarek knows exactly what would happen to him. He stumbled on a taboo. Quote, there are subjects, this is from him, he says, there are subjects you don't even talk or think about. Sarek says, among them, race, gender, and homosexuality. In other words, it doesn't really matter to this man. It really doesn't matter whether it's truth or not. Boy, there are certain things, whether truth or not, that isn't what's important. What's important that you teach what's politically correct, even if it's totally false. And of course, he's sold out to the system because truth isn't what matters. What matters is being accepted or being popular or keeping your job. That's what matters. And he understands that he'd be guilty of thought crimes. And the thought police would be down on his back like fleas on a dog. Let's go now to paragraph 11. Paragraph 11 and sentences 1 and 2, it says, PC is, strictly speaking, a totalitarian philosophy. No aspect of university life is too obscure to come under its scrutiny. The University of Connecticut issued a proclamation banning inappropriate... Let me stop there for a minute. Again, PC is, strictly speaking, a totalitarian philosophy. No aspect of university life is too obscure to come under its scrutiny. Now, it says it's totalitarianism. Let's examine what totalitarianism is. In Webster's New Collegiate Dictionary, again, it describes totalitarianism as a centralized control by an autocratic authority. Secondly, it says the political concept that the citizen should be totally subject to an absolute state authority. Now, I want to just ask you these questions for you to think about as we continue in this message and the message to come. It says, again, that it's that totalitarianism is a centralized control by an autocratic authority. Political concept that the citizen should be totally subject to an absolute state authority. Who is, I want you to think about this, who is the controlling absolute authority in these particular cases or in what this is dealing with? Who is doing the manipulating and brainwashing, and to what purpose? Just consider that for future reference. Now let's go on. Paragraph 11 and the rest of the statement. It says, no aspect of university life is too obscure to come under its scrutiny. The University of Connecticut issued, listen, a proclamation banning, quote, inappropriately directed laughter, end quote. They've gone now from thought crimes to crimes of laughter. I mean, when they said, man, it covers everything. They were certain that was certainly true. All I can say is Bob and Joe and Hirsch and your families, you just better be real careful. You better be careful at what and who you laugh at. Because who knows? The time will come when the laughter police will be knocking on your door. It goes on. It also says the University of Connecticut issued a proclamation banning, quote, inappropriate directed laughter, end quote, and, quote, conspicuous exclusion of students from conversations, end quote. In other words, you can't choose even who your friends are. That's left up to them as well. You leave them out. In other words, if you don't want to be friends, or if you don't want to talk to queers and lesbians, you don't have that right. If you don't want to be associated with the blacks and the Mexicans for whatever reason, you don't have that right. You know, I don't guess the universities would probably like the separatist teaching that's found, for example, in 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 13, where it says, therefore come out from their midst and be separate. Or 1 Corinthians 15:33, where it says, do not be deceived. Bad company corrupts good morals. I don't think they'd probably accept that. Let's go to paragraph 12, in sentences 1 through 3. It says, one of the most controversial PC initiatives took place at the University of Texas at Austin, where the English faculty recently chose a new text for the freshman composition course. Composition course, that's what the course that's being discussed here, which is required for about half of the entering undergraduates. Up till now, instructors had been free to assign essays on a range of topics for students to read and discuss. Henceforth, all readings will be from an anthology called Racism and Sexism, an Integrated Study by Paula S. Rothenberg. Now notice, it was a composition class that is now simply being used. The purpose was composition, but it is being used to indoctrinate and brainwash on the areas of racism and sexism. And I know some of you already caught who the author was, a Jewish woman. Paragraph 12, continuing, sentences 4 and 7. It says, selections, some of which are excellent, comprise a primer of PC thought. In the first chapter, Rothenberg answers what many white men wonder, but few dare ask. Why are they the only ones ever accused of racism or sexism? Sounds like a pretty good question, right there in that book. Sounds like this book may not be near as bad as we thought it was. Well, let's continue. It says, the sine qua non of racism and sexism, Rothenberg explains, is subordination, which in Western society is exercised only by whites over blacks and men over women. Hence, reverse racism and sexism, by definition, do not exist. Now, did you note, as I read that, you know, it wasn't near as good as we thought it was, did you catch the racism in what she says? But of course, hers is acceptable racism. There's no standard. It's just more lies and, of course, more mind control. Continuing then on with that same paragraph. Sentence 8, it begins, Professor Alan Gibbon was one of the minority who objected to this approach to teaching composition. He derided the course as oppression studies by dictating the content of the readings. He charged the department, quote, presumes the content is more important is the more important thing about the writing course, end quote. But that is just the point. In the context of PC, political content is the most important thing about everything. Why? Because the primary criteria, at least in this day and age, appears to be, of the universities, is brainwashing a generation of students. Composition isn't what's most important. Learning to read, no wonder our people can't read. Learning to write, so forth and so on. Those things are not what's most important in this day and age. It's political correctness, meaning a planned brainwashing of a generation of people. Continuing on with this article now, in paragraph 14 it says, sure, you have the right to speech, says Kate Fahey, an associate dean at Mount Holyoke College. But I want you to know, what is it going to do to our community? Is it going to damage us? And it goes, end quote. And it says, when a few students last spring mocked Mount Holyoke's Lesbian Bisexual Awareness Week by proclaiming, quote, Heterosexual Awareness Week, end quote, President Elizabeth Kennan unbraided them for violating the spirit of the community. You know, again, I thought that PC was opposed to prejudice. Well, aren't they being a prejudice to those who want heterosexual, their own heterosexual week? Isn't it prejudice to only allow the lesbians and the gays to have that kind of week? You know, it is, again, as I mentioned, they said we're against the goal is to eliminate prejudice, but they define what prejudice is. Nobody could read that and not say that is prejudice. But they've defined what is prejudice and what is not acceptable. There's no equal protection under the system. Okay, moving on to paragraph 21. We'll have to move here quickly to get through this. Paragraph 21 says, the rejection of hierarchy underlies another key PC tenet, multiculturalism. This is an attack on the primacy of the Western intellectual tradition as handed down through centuries of great books. In the PC view, this canon perpetuates the power of dead white males over women and blacks from beyond the grave. And notice that they have declared in that statement who the enemy really is. Whites. Specifically, white males, even dead white males. They have a fear. They have a dread of white people, of whites. Even dead whites they're afraid of, which I find amazing. But maybe justifiably so. Let me read a poem by Rudyard Kipling. It's called Beware, the Wrath of the the Awakened Saxon and the World Trembled in Fear. It was not a part of their blood. It came to them very late, with long arrears to make good when the Saxons began to hate. They were not easily moved. They were icy, willing to wait till every count should be proved ere the Saxons began to hate. Their voices were even and low, their eyes were level and straight. There was neither sign nor show when the Saxons began to hate. It was not preached to the crowd, it was not taught by the state. No man spoke it aloud when the Saxons began to hate. It was not suddenly bred, it will not swiftly abate. Through the chilled years ahead, when time shall count from the date that the Saxons began to hate. Notice it's not natural for the Saxons, for those peoples to hate. But there comes a time when they get fed up to that point where they can take it no longer, that I believe the time will come when, quote-unquote, the Saxons begin to hate. And maybe they do have reason to fear. I think they probably know that there will be that time when justice will reign supreme and their unrighteousness will prevail no longer. Let me go on. Paragraph now, number 21. It says, the rejection, or continuing with paragraph number 21. Later it says, in opposition to this Eurocentric view of the world, Molef Asante, chairperson of African American Studies at Temple, has proposed an Afrocentric curriculum. It would be based on the thoughts of ancient African scholars and the little-known cultures of modern East and West Africa. This would be one of the many such ethnic-specific curricula he foresees in a multicultural America. There are only two positions, Asante says sweepingly. Either you support multiculturalism in American education, or you support the maintenance of white supremacy. Basically, he's saying we want to promote pluralism and integration to a further degree. And he says, basically, it leaves you, if you don't want to do it, it leaves you with two choices, or the two choices are, you either support multiculturalism in American education, or you support the maintenance of white supremacy. Well, I've got another way to put it. There's another choice, or another way to look at that choice. It's either looking at race annihilation or race preservation, and not just of the whites. Those who would oppose multiculturalism, in other words, or pluralism, or integration. It doesn't have to be looked as white supremacy. It can be simply looked upon, the choice being race annihilation or race preservation. And again, not of whites only. We understand that God made the races separate at one point in time in history, that he quote-unquote created them to be different from each other, and that like was to beget like, that God intends what he created in that fashion to continue in that fashion. We're for the preservation of the race and the laws that would help support that. Paragraphs 22 and 23. He says, but Asante is proposing a change in values, not just reading lists. So what if the Western tradition gives rise to individual liberty? Is liberty necessarily a universal value? African cultures, he points out, exalt the familiar ideal community. There's a paragraph I should have read before that. It says, it is statements like that, of course, that sends members of the National Association of Scholars stomping into bookstores in a rage. To Stephen Balk, president of the organization, it is a dereliction of duty for educators to admit that every culture can be equally valid. Western civilization has earned its place in the center of university curriculum, not by the accident that most university professors have been white males, but by its self-evident virtue. It has given rise to the single most compelling idea of human history, individual liberty, which, as it happens, is just now sweeping the entire world. But Asante is proposing a change in values, not just reading lists. So what if the Western tradition gives rise to individual liberty? Is liberty necessarily a universal value? African cultures, he points out, exalt the familiar ideal, community. Finally, in this whole article, near the end of it, we finally have some truth. It's finally there. Note at the same time the double standard. A distinction is very clearly made by Asante, this black man, between the races. But it's an acceptable incident. Why? Because the distinction between the races was made by a black man and not a white man. And the distinction elevates the black community, not the white community or individual. So it's an acceptable incident, but truth is truth, and there it is. Let's go to the very last paragraph. It says, yes, of course, conflict is inevitable. As the university makes the transition somewhat ahead of the rest of society toward its multi-ethnic future, there are, in fact, some who recognize the tyranny of PC, but see it only as a transitional phase which will no longer be necessary once the virtues of tolerance are internalized. Does that sound familiar? It's the dictatorship of the proletariat to be followed by the withering away of the state. These should be interesting years. This last paragraph declares very clearly the purpose for these experiments taking place on our universities. And that is that all of it, and all of it, of course, in agreement with what Bertrand Russell had to say, and that is that the university is simply a means to the end, a totally pluralistic society. Or is that just a front, a facade for a greater purpose even beyond all of that? Well, if you